All people at all places and all times have a common enemy. And it's not communism. It's aging. It is decay. It is sickness, injustice, oppression. And all of these things have the same conclusion, which is death. And you're like, Pastor, you're going there already. We're in our bright colors. This is Easter egg day. And we say, no, it's not. We get to dress in brightness and hunt for Easter eggs and have fun with families because of the most horrific death in human history. Now, across cultures and times, there are two responses to death. The first response, which is newer, recent, it's American, and it's European. And it's that there's nothing after death. You exist accidentally, and you will die, and then there's nothing. And given 5, 10, 15 years, no one will ever remember who you are. And life will just continue as it always has until one day the sun decides to go kaput. And you no longer exist. That's recent, that's American, that's European, that's sophisticated. But there is an older, ancient idea that I think surpasses cultural traditions and religions. And the dominant idea across our history of human beings is that there is life after death. It doesn't matter if it's a small indigenous tribe in Central Africa, all the way to Branchton today. People, the dominant idea across peoples and time is that there is life after death. But what does all this mean? What this reveals is that there is so much uncertainty, and there's so much fear, and there's so much doubt about death. And I'm here today to tell you that honestly, there is no philosophy and there is no religion that has a meaningful enough answer to aging and sickness and sorrow and death. You can go across the bay and search at all the philosophies on the other side of our bay, and you still will not find it. The agnostic belief that has ravaged Europe and jumped across the pond to America that says that there's nothing after death, you know what this does? It provides no refuge, no meaning, no help for life today and when we take our last breath. It just does not. And the varying beliefs about death and afterlife across the major religions of the world, they also do not provide a meaningful enough answer to death. So if I don't live right now, I come back in a different station of life and I'm stuck on this wheel and it just keeps churning. You see, only Christianity and Christianity alone provides a sufficient answer to death. The promises and the proofs of resurrection or why I am a Christian. And I think that many, many people in this room today are Christians. And I pray that if you are not a Christian today, that you would consider the proofs of resurrection. The death and resurrection of God in flesh is the most meaningful response to evil and injustice and suffering that we have on this planet. Only Christianity says that evil and suffering and death are so bad, it is so heinous, that God will step into our world and he will take care of it himself. Today we're going to see how the death and resurrection of Jesus, how it undermines and destroys our doubts and our fears and our uncertainties about life today and death when it's all done and what it's really about. Let's get into our big idea, our proposition for today. And it's simply this, that the resurrection of Jesus, it destroys fears and doubts about life and about death. Now, one of the major ways that the religions of the world are different from Christianity is that all of its founders or chief figures are dead. And there's no push in those major religions of the world to argue that their founders or their chief figures are still alive. Moses is dead. Muhammad is dead. Siddhartha Gautama is dead. Lao Tzu is dead. Joseph Smith is dead. The fundamental premise of Christianity is that its chief founder, God himself, the Son of God, who created all things, took on flesh, he died, and he rose from the dead. Christianity alone claims that sin and evil has ravaged humanity. And the only thing that could stop this was God taking on flesh to stop it. You see, death has fangs. And the death of Jesus takes the fangs out of our death. Now, all people, understandably so, have uncertainty and fear and doubt about Christianity. Today, we get to throw our uncertainty and our fears and our doubts about life and about death into Jesus' empty tomb. Our fears and doubts about Jesus are resolved when we begin to take a look at the earliest evidences for Jesus. You see, Matthew and Luke, our two scripture readings this morning that Satina presented and I presented moments ago, they were written 40, maybe 50 years after the resurrection of Jesus. But you know what? We have documents that are even earlier than that. We have documents that we believe were written 20 years after the resurrection of Jesus. And one of them is a letter that Paul wrote to some Greek Christians. It's called 1 Corinthians. And I wanted you to take a look at what one of the earliest claims, 20 years in writing that we have, says about Jesus. It's 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3 through 8. And Paul says that I deliver to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, that he appeared to Cephas, which is just Peter, then to the 12, and then he appeared, listen to this, to more than 500 brethren at one time, and most of whom remain until now. Remember, 20 years later. But some have fallen asleep. They've passed away. And then he appeared to James, and then to all the apostles. And then last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared to me also. This is eyewitness testimony. Paul's claim is that the death and resurrection of Jesus is the fulfillment of the Jewish scriptures about Messiah. Passover, which we just finished celebrating, Good Friday on Friday night, it points to Jesus' sacrifice and death and resurrection. He's the ultimate Moses. He is the ultimate Passover lamb. Jesus provided proofs to these promises. He was raised on the third day of his death, which is why Christians, since the resurrection, has come together on Sunday mornings, because that's when Jesus resurrected from the dead. He appeared multiple times to multiple people, at least 514 people. Now, Paul's argument is this. You don't have to doubt the resurrection. But if you are unsure of what has happened, you can go to these people. You can have a cup of coffee with them, or whatever they had in the mornings in first century Israel, and you can ask them for yourself. But you and I, we don't have that luxury today, do we not? But Luke, our scripture reading this morning, a second generation Christian, he did. He took Paul's words seriously because Paul mentored him. And he went to Israel and he interviewed people. He researched and he wrote it all down for a guy that he was mentoring named Theophilus. And he also wrote Acts for Theophilus as well, and still for us today. Their testimony that they were eyewitnesses is what we turn to when we become uncertain about the claims of life, death, and resurrection. Here's why this is important today. We believe as Christians that putting your hope in the resurrection of Jesus for this life, it takes the sting out of all of our deaths. It undermines our fears and our doubts and our uncertainties about life today and death maybe tomorrow. Today we're going to see how Jesus' resurrection undermines and destroys all of those fears and all of those doubts. And then we're going to see how a personal encounter like Peter did, how this resolves in wonder, and all of his fears are washed away. Let's go ahead and begin. Let's take a look at our first point. And what I think that we need to do through the women who came to see Jesus is that we today still need to remember how the resurrection of Jesus resolves our fears about death. I think we're all on the same page right now that we all have uncertainty about life, right? We all have uncertainty about death. It's the great equalizer. Man or woman, rich or poor, strong or weak, no matter your color, we are all going to die one day. And deep down, every single one of us has a problem with death. Deep down, we know that death is not how life is supposed to be lived. So who has it right? The modern, sophisticated people from Europe and America who says there's nothing? Or what the dominant encouragement of all cultures and all places have had, that this life is not all that there is, and that there is something after this? Who has it right? Do you cease to exist after death? Or is there life after death? What can we rely on to answer these questions in a deeply meaningful and satisfying way? And that is where resurrection comes in. Jesus was crucified on Good Friday, just before Passover sun set for Sabbath. And on Sunday morning, after Sabbath was finished, these women, I don't think they could wait to go to Jesus' tomb. That's why they went early in the morning. That's why traditionally we have church not at 10:45, but usually when the sun rose in antiquity, that's when the church met. They bring spices because they want to care for the body of Jesus. And when they approach Jesus' tomb, lo and behold, they find the stone then rolled away, and they go inside, and Jesus is nowhere to be found. And as the women are trying to make sense of what they are experiencing, two men suddenly appear before them, like, whoa, right? These are no ordinary men. Luke tells us from what he researched and interviewed, these men, the best way he could put it for us in English, so they had this dazzling clothing on. And what this is really trying to get to the point of, these men and their appearance was like a flash of lightning. It just makes you go, whoa. This is a supernatural moment. And I have to say this before we begin. If your belief system or the framework that you have to understand life, if it mandates that all things must have a natural explanation or you're not going to believe them, if you come to life that way, you're going to struggle with this. You're going to struggle with all the details surrounding the resurrection of Jesus. What this means is that your current belief system, the framework, the grid that you understand life, is getting in your way of truly getting a resolution to all of this. So why do you hold on to it? But this is what the Bible describes as an angel. The presence of an angel means that the explanation behind the empty tomb of Jesus is a supernatural explanation. So what this means, like modern, well, not modern, several hundred years ago, scholars like in Germany and Europe started saying, no, Jesus didn't really, you know, die and was raised from the dead. There has to be a natural explanation. So they began to develop these ideas like, you know what? Maybe someone ambushed these professional soldiers, overthrew them, they pushed the stone away, and they took the body of Jesus to make it seem like his claims were true. That's like a 200-year-old idea. Now, some of them would say, well, you know what? We're learning more medically. Maybe Jesus didn't die. There's this thing that makes it appear as if the body is dead, and then sometime later, they're just resuscitated. And they honestly then believe that Jesus, in a sealed-off tomb, was just resuscitated. After all the agony of the cross, spear in the side, he just woke up and had the power to roll the stone away. He just walked away. What this means is that the explanation for why the body of Jesus is not in the tomb has to be a supernatural explanation, one that goes above and beyond logical explanation. And I do have to say, I think it takes more faith to believe in these modern theories than what has been the evidence for 2,000 years. But then one of the angels speaks, and I want you to take a look at it in verse 5. He tells these women, He asks, why do you seek the living one among the dead? Now, this is one of the most comforting words that we can hear about death. Jesus was dead, but he's alive. And we got to ask, how can this be? We read the accounts on Friday. Jesus hung on a Roman cross, overseen by the Roman government, witnessed by Jerusalem's religious authorities. They walked up to him and mocked him, wagged their fingers at him. Plenty to see that he suffered and died. Roman soldiers were professionals at crucifixion. They invented the capital punishment of crucifixion. This is unique to their culture. And remember, Jerusalem wanted to hurry up and finish the crucifixions that day for the men hanging on the cross so they could go celebrate Passover Sabbath with their friends and family. So Roman soldiers, they go to the two other criminals on the cross. They were still alive. So what do they do in this situation? They break the legs of those who are still alive. Because what they would do, they would use their bodies to kind of push off the cross, give them a little bit of temporary relief. Breaking the legs meant they would no longer be able to do that. But then these professional crucifiers come to Jesus, and they did not break Jesus' legs. Why? I think they've done one or two crucifixions before, sadly. And they know the difference being a professional soldier as to what is a dead body and what is a live body. They did not break the legs of Jesus because he was already dead. So instead, we read this from John, that they take a spear, they plunge it through his side, and blood and water rushes out. Jesus' death is real. And any other recent explanation that came out of Europe 200 years ago requires more faith than simply believing the facts that have stood for thousands of years. This is resurrection. And resurrection resolves our fears about death. Take a look with me through verses 6 and 7 right now. The angel continues and tells the women that he's not here. He has risen. And then he tells them, remember. Remember how he spoke to you while he was still in Galilee, saying that the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified, and the third day rise again. The angel tells the women that Jesus rose from the dead. He's not in the tomb, for he has risen. Dead has come back to life. And you don't look for the living among the dead. Then the angel calls on the women to remember. Jesus told them that this was going to happen. We looked at it 2 weeks ago. Now, this is what I want us to do for a moment. We must remember the death and resurrection of Jesus. For his death and his resurrection, it resolves our fears. Fears about life and fears about death. You see, death is not becoming nothing. And Jesus' death proves this. After death, one day for us will be resurrection. So how does Jesus' resurrection resolve your fears about life and death and my fears about life and death? You see, death is not non-existence. Death is not some cosmic reset where, you know, you are somewhere else on the wheel of life and then you come off and then the all soul puts you somewhere else. That's not what life and death is about. Neither idea meaningfully deals with our fears. But if God who created all things, God who created humanity, if God who was offended by evil and injustice and oppression and suffering and sins that we've committed, if he takes on flesh and he dies for it all and lives again, then that changes everything that we think about life and everything that we think we know about death. It challenges your framework, your belief system, the grid that you use today to understand yourself and to understand people, to understand life and to understand death. It changes everything. The resurrection of Jesus takes the final sting out of death for the Christian. Jesus' death defangs death. And so now death is impotent. We must remember that the Old Testament, hundreds, 700, up to 1,000 years before the birth of Jesus. And Jesus himself directly taught us that one day, God would take on flesh, Messiah would suffer, he would die, and he would live again. Because the only way that evil and suffering and death can be fully dealt with is if someone stronger than evil and suffering and death takes it on. And there's only one person in human history that's more powerful than death. And it's not Thanos. It's Jesus. Which is just Greek for death. God takes on and defeats death through the death of his one and only Son. Resurrection instills confidence in Jesus' words and promises. Resurrection proves Jesus' words about life and about death, about resurrection and about life eternal. So this is it. This is what I need you to think for a moment with me. If Jesus is right about death and resurrection, then Jesus is right about everything. Do you get that logic? If we don't handle it this way, how can we say he's right about death, but he's not right about how I live my life? Who gets to decide where Jesus is right and who Jesus is wrong? That means you do, which means you are in the superposition over Jesus. But you're not stronger than death. So that type of logic falters. If Jesus is right about death and resurrection, he's right about everything. And that's what Christians believe. And therefore, our framework, our belief system, our grids, we must be shaped by what Jesus says. This is what you are called to remember today. Resurrection resolves all of our fears about life and death. Let's move on now to our second and final point. Okay. Doubt is destroyed. And it is destroyed when you wonder at the resurrection of Jesus. And this is what Peter is going to teach us right now. We all have had doubts about Jesus. We all have had doubts about Jesus, his claims about life, his claims about death, and his claims about resurrection. Now, despite this, if this is you, and it's okay if this is you, but can you acknowledge for a moment that if Jesus is who he says he is, that he is God who created all things, who took on evil, if those claims are right, can't he be stronger than death? Right? What I encourage you today, don't stop thinking. Don't stop reasoning. Don't stop challenging. Or become combative against the claims of Christianity just because you doubt it. Because the best place to be, if you have reservations and doubts about the claims of Christianity, is right here. Not necessarily only right here exclusively, but what I mean is a Bible-focused preaching, teaching church. Christianity teaches that God the Father, despite being powerful over death, he exposed his Son to the death that we deserve. And if Jesus was just human, think about this. If Jesus was just human, the story would have stopped right there. This doesn't get enough acclaim and spotlight. But did you know that leading up to the birth of Jesus and the death of Jesus, there were many people at the turn of that century that claimed to be the Messiah? Did you know that? Jerusalem had to put down time and time again insurrectionists who told the people, I'm the Son of God. They put that resurrection down. They killed that person. Their story stopped right there. They thought that Jesus was just another person in the line of insurrectionists that came through Jerusalem to say, I'm the Son of God. And when they destroyed him, their following would be destroyed as well. But Christianity did not stop at the death of Jesus. It ignited a revolution that has lasted thousands of years. And if you doubt the claims of Christianity, you got to ask why. What was so different? Other Messiah figures had cult followings. Why this man? Because he is more than just a man. He is who he says he is. Now, Just because you doubt how all of this works out doesn't make it true. I don't know how an engine works. I don't. I don't think I ever will. Some of y'all do. But just because I doubt how the mechanics works doesn't mean I don't think engines are real and that they work and operate to get me from A to B. Just because I don't really know how, I forgot the rate of gravity, negative 3-point-something, I don't know, forgot physics by this point. But just because I don't get all of how gravity works doesn't mean that it's not true. You see, doubt is like mud on your windshield. And if you just try to move on and drive through it and just go squirt, 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 smear, 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 right? All you're going to do is just make it worse. If you try to move on and just drive with it, it obstructs your vision until something more powerful than the mud can wash it away. The resolution to our doubts is wonder. And we're going to see that in Peter right now. After the women who followed Jesus spoke with the angel, they returned to the apostles. They report everything that they experienced to these men. And we need to take a look at their response. Because I think it's going to create some understanding and maybe some empathy in this room for those who doubt and for those who struggle. Let's take a look at verse 11. Luke tells us that these words that the women spoke appeared to these men as nonsense, and they wouldn't believe them. These are the men who followed Jesus. This is Peter, the rock. Now, two things should pop out. The testimony of the women, nonsense to these men. They would not believe the testimony of these women. And we have to understand the cultural moment right now to get why. In the first century Roman world, the testimony of a woman did not hold weight in a court of law. And it wasn't just a Roman court of law. It was even their own culture. Even in a Jewish court of law, a woman's testimony meant nothing. Can you imagine that? If after 2,000 years of Christianity in this country, if every single woman's testimony and experience meant nothing in a court of law, thank God for the cross because it changed everything. 10,000 women could have witnessed the resurrection of Jesus, and their testimony would not hold weight in a court of law. Good, bad, or otherwise, that's the cultural moment that these women were living in. And you got to think, what impact does this cultural idea have on these 11 men when they hear, Jesus has risen from the dead. We saw these two men, dazzling clothing. He said, why do you look for the living among the dead? And they're like, yeah, right. It's too incredible for them to believe. Now, here's what you need to ask yourself. If the claims of Christianity about the death and resurrection are just conjured up by men 200 or 300 years later, why would the most important watershed moments come from the testimony of women? Think about that. Let me put you in the power position. If you were making up Christianity right now, you can just build it however you want from the ground up. But you're in this first century Roman society. Why would you base Christianity completely upon the witness and testimony of someone that your culture would say, yeah, right? We could even go to court about it, and the judge would say, nope, doesn't hold weight. The only explanation that's meaningful and satisfying is that these women's claims are true. You wouldn't do that if you're making up your own religion. Their testimony at first seems like nonsense. The apostles don't believe the women. Ah, but Peter. Something happened inside of Peter, and he moves to action. This is our final verse. Let's take a look at it. In verse 12, it says that Peter got up. He ran to the tomb. He stooped in. He looked in. He saw the linen wrappings only. And then he went away to his own home. And this is the last phrase I really want us to target today. He went away marveling at what had happened. Notice what Peter did. Peter thought it was nonsense. Peter did not believe the women, but he didn't stop there. He wasn't intellectually, emotionally, or physically lazy. He acted on his doubts to verify claims. And Peter, like all of us, we need to personally experience what the women told him. This would be a life-changing moment for Peter. Think about it. I don't know, was it maybe 50 hours ago? 55 hours ago? A little slave girl goes up to Peter and says, like, your accent, you sound like a Galilean. You sound like a follower of Jesus. He's like, no, I'm not. That was like 50-something hours ago. And now he's marveling at the empty tomb. How does a person change like that in 50-something hours? Never again would Peter deny Jesus to others. You see, Peter's doubts were undermined when he wondered at the resurrection. But what about you and I? You see, unlike Peter, man, it's so easy, right? I was talking about one of the guys over dinner, I don't know, recently. It just would have been so easy for us if we could go to the empty tomb and see. And just prove it right then and there on the spot. He's right or wrong, and let's base all of our lives on it if it's true. And if it's not, let's go kayaking, right? But unlike Peter, you and I can't go to the empty tomb. Unlike Peter, you and I, we can't see the empty tomb. We can't touch the linen wrappings that was once around the body of Jesus. But despite this, like Peter, your doubts and my doubts, your fears and my fears, they're destroyed in the same way that Peter's was. But it all depends on what you do with your doubts. It all depends on this. That's what it hinges on today. My encouragement is that you take your doubts, and it's okay to name it. These are my doubts. And you throw it on Peter's testimony. You throw it on Luke's testimony and Matthew's testimony and these women's testimony. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Paul, Peter, James, Jude. You see, you have the testimony of what we call the New Testament. Not one book, 27 letters, gospels, written 20 to 60 years after this moment. Now, I want you to think about it this way. Just give me a head nod if you're still alive. Do you believe that Julius Caesar is a real person? Give me a head nod. Do you? I know you do. Ryan gets always the brunt because as I'm just doing my stage delivery, I'm just going left, right. Sorry, David, because you're right. He's left. And so sometimes you get, I don't know, eyeballs from me. Of course you believe that Julius Caesar is a real historical person. But the question you have to ask yourself is, why do you believe that Julius Caesar is real? He was the first great king of Rome who changed everything for human history just a generation before the birth of Christ. You believe he's real because of the historical evidence, right? But here's the reality. The majority of our evidence, other than like statues or coins, comes from one document written by a nerd named Plutarch. 200 years after the death of Caesar by Brutus. Did you know that? One document, 200 years. That's all we got. That's the earliest evidence. And all of you, except for Ryan, said that you believe that Jesus is a real historical person. Let's compare that to Jesus for a moment. One document, 200 years after. 27 texts written by over a half dozen men, not 200 years after, but 20 to 60 years after the resurrection of Jesus. In a court of law today, what do you think is going to hold the weight, the greater weight? I believe that Julius is real. I'm not saying that he's not. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. But what holds the greater weight and testimony in a court of law? Come on. Plutarch wasn't even an eyewitness to Julius's life. But Matthew and John and Peter and James and Jude were. Mark and Luke, our other gospel writers, They were mentored by people like Peter and Paul. They traveled with them. They verified these things. So what more proof do you need? But here's the thing. The issue isn't the proof. Because you have the ability to believe in a figure like Julius based on one document. The problem isn't the proof. The problem is your doubts. The problem is you're afraid and you are uncertain and you're doubtful about life and death. That is the roadblock, not the historical record. Your doubts are like mud that gets smeared. Yes, I said smeared on the windshield. And if you turn those windshield wipers on, all it's gonna do is spread the mud all over the place and make it worse. If you got better windshield wipers, let me know so I can buy that. But there's a different way to remove the mud, right? Something with higher pressure and wet can clean it up. And there's a different way to push doubt away than just pushing Jesus away. There's a better way. Learn from Peter. Learn from the apostles. They didn't just sit idly by, just pretending and just going back to life after today as if nothing happened. You can't do that. So what's the difference between them and us today? What is it about us that we don't want, or that we want to doubt the words of Jesus and the claims of Jesus? What is it about the way that we want to live that makes us doubt Jesus? That's the issue, not the record, not the evidence. What's motivating our doubts? But if you stay there, if you stay encumbered by your fears and your doubts, it is not going to meaningfully prepare you for life, and it's not going to satisfyingly prepare you for death, your death or a loved one's death. You will simply just continue to turn the windshield on, the wiper on, spray that water, and just hope, just keep doing the same thing over and over again, you're going to get a clean windshield again. When instead it's just going to make your vision worse. Resurrection proves that Jesus died for the sins and the sorrows that we've experienced and the sins and the sorrows that we've put onto other people in our lives. It proves what Jesus promises about the future. It's what our brother Vernon loves, eschatology, that one day he will return. And at his return, all sin, evil, and suffering find two reconciling points. Either one in this life at the cross, or two at his return on a throne, not a cross, but a throne. Now, even if you doubt the resurrection and the claims of Jesus, I think this. Deep down, you should want it to be true. You should want to. And here's why. You have a deep sense of justice. When someone says something against or does something in someone that you love, you want vengeance, right? You have a deep sense of justice. And some of y'all, you have a deeper sense of justice than I do. Deep down, you want every wrong to be righted. And you are not satisfied until it is. And you know what? You can't provide it. Law enforcement can't provide it. The court system cannot provide it. Only someone more powerful than evil and death can do this. And only Jesus can do it. If you doubt the resurrection of Jesus, here's my encouragement today. It's okay. You're in good company. You're in good company. You are surrounded by people who at one point or even right now perhaps has their fears and reservations and uncertainties about life and death as well. So my encouragement on this Resurrection Sunday, there's just one thing for you to take away, is that you need to begin to doubt your doubts. I say this every so often to our people here in Branchton, but you need to doubt your doubts. This will lead you, like Peter, to action, which will end and resolve itself in wonder at the resurrection of Jesus, whether it's for the first time or whether you just need to be renewed today. Like Peter, when you doubt, don't just sit there just expecting that just doing the same thing over and over again, I'm going to spread the water and turn my wipers on and it's going to give me what I need. It's not. Wonder destroys doubt. And I pray that you will wonder at the death and the resurrection of Jesus, the Son of God, who took on the death that we deserve so that we could take on the life that he deserves. And that's the preaching God's word this Resurrection Sunday. Amen.